We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm happy to be joined by Ian Rowe. He is the author of the new book, Agency, the 4-point plan for children to overcome the victimhood narrative and discover their pathway to power. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
So great to see you, although I know we're just on audio. But thank you, so that's great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and you're working to basically start a high school in the Bronx. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, sure. Well, once again, thanks for having me on. Yeah, you know, while I have a think tank hat on, you know, a lot of my work is about how to bring ideas to young people and how to help young people get a better understanding of the power that they do have in their own lives. I mean, for the last year, I ran a network of public charter schools in the heart of the South Bronx and the Lower East Side of Manhattan. These were all, you know, 2,000 kids, almost all low-income kids, Black and Hispanic. Each year when we ran our lottery, we had nearly 5,000 families on our wait list. You get a real sense of just parents who are in search of the American dream for their kids. And so that was an amazing experience running a network for 10 years. But now I'm launching a new international baccalaureate high school focused on the cardinal virtues of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And it's a different kind of school in that you'll be able to, at the end of your sophomore year, choose to either pursue a traditional college or university pathway or choose a careers pathway where you could study computer science, architecture, healthcare, so you can actually have an industry credential with labor market value at the end of 4 years of high school. So if you want to get a job, if that's what you so choose, you'd have that option. And it's part of, and we'll talk about my overall theory around agency, but it's giving more young people more pathways to their own determination of what success means in their own lives.
Again, the book is obviously called Agency, and that word has already been used many times, and I think it will continue to be used many times over the course of this discussion. But you actually ask right away in the book, what is agency? And that's probably as good a place as any to begin our discussion. How do you define agency, Ian, and how do you think maybe that differs from our cultural understanding of agency?
Yeah, well, agency is all about this idea of leading a self-determined life. And let me just step back to provide a little bit of context for my more nuanced definition. And, you know, over my time running schools and interacting with young people of all races around the country, you know, I've had the incredible experience of working at MTV, the White House, the Gates Foundation, running charter schools. And I've really had some insight into what drives success or failure for young people and what they have to believe. And it's really been accelerated in the last couple of years in that I see these two dominant meta-narratives emerging. One I call blame the system, and the other I call blame the victim. In the blame the system narrative, that's a view of America, if you're not achieving the American dream, it's because America itself is the problem. It's an inherently oppressive country based on your race, your gender, some immutable characteristic. You know, there's a white supremacist lurking on every corner. Capitalism itself is evil. Like, these systems are so rigged against you that the only way that you can succeed is if there's some massive government intervention. And on the other side, there's the other narrative I call blame the victim. That if you're not successful, it's not America's the problem, you're the problem, right? Somehow you are the architect of your own failure. You have not pulled yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's your fault. And these two dominant meta-narratives, in my view, are these half-truths that add up to a singular lie, robbing young people of the belief that they can craft their own future. That's robbing them of agency. And I think young people today need a new framework. And so I've created my own definition of agency, which is the force of your free will guided by moral discernment. The force of your free will guided by moral discernment. So if you have the power to choose, right? If you have free will, the question is, where do you learn the ability to discern what is right and what is wrong? And this is where I also introduce in my book a new framework called FREE: family, religion, education, and entrepreneurship. We can dive into each of those, but those four pillars, if more young people were to embrace those institutions, I think we'd see a revolution in young people who today are experiencing high levels of isolation, loneliness, depression. I think we'd see a very different set of empowered young Americans.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask somebody who spent so much time in education as you have, in the aftermath of what we're taping this on Wednesday. I think that's what today is. But in the aftermath of the tragedy that unfolded yesterday in Texas, you just mentioned the alienation that a lot of young people feel. And without, even getting into policy or specifics, unless you want to, I'll just say in the context, so many Americans are frustrated with what seems to play out time and again in these, it is like a playbook, in these horrible, horrible school shootings. Are there, if we look at the free framework, family, religion, education, and entrepreneurship, how do you think a renewed cultural focus on all of those pillars might play into making our schools safer and healthier places as well?
Yeah, well, without diagnosing this particular incident, which was horrific, almost all of these, though, it seems like there were warning signs. It seems like there was something in the child's background, whether it be an abusive family structure or some other set of conditions, that sent the signal that this particular kid was alienated in some way or part of a community that was destructive. And so often, what young people are missing today are the nurturing supports early that allow them to be able to discern right from wrong. The reason FREE, I think, can be so powerful, this idea of family, religion, education, entrepreneurship, the F in family, it's not about the family that you're from, it's about the family that you form. So even if you're in a challenging situation, as you make your decisions, as you enter young adulthood, it's all about how to build healthy relationships, how to, even court your partner. But probably for this discussion, the R is very important. So religion, this idea of building a personal faith commitment. Unfortunately, religiosity is actually on the decline, particularly amongst young people in our country. It's actually the fastest growing category called nuns, it's like no religious affiliation. And that's a real problem, because for young people that do embrace a traditional religion, dramatically lower levels of depression, dramatically lower levels of isolation, dramatically lower levels of loneliness, because you're almost inherently part of a community of people that have your back. That when you start to maybe encounter mental health issues or other challenges, there's your family, there's a larger support system. So my hope is that, I know in the immediate aftermath of these kinds of events, we immediately start talking about things like gun control and other technical interventions, and there might be an appropriate place for that, but we can never ignore the incredibly important and powerful nurturing role of families, faith community, because frankly, those are probably the best defenses against this kind of antisocial behavior.
So this is actually, sadly, sort of a perfect segue into a lot of what you talk about. And actually, one of the quotes the great Yuval Levin pulled out in his preface or his intro to your book is where you write, pure self-reliance is a myth. And as we look not just to this tragedy, the tragic patterns of mass shootings, but also to increases in violent crime, suicides all over the country, pure self-reliance is a myth, as you write, because there are also communities, and communities are nets. And I remember my old editor, Tim Carney, defending vigorously the "it takes a village" line, because in some ways it really does. And there's obviously sort of a context there. But what can you tell us about the nuance in that line where you say pure self-reliance is a myth? What does maybe, let's just start with the right, miss in the emphasis on pure self-reliance?
Yeah, I think, and I think that the blame the victim ideology is often ascribed to people on the right because there's just not a recognition of the importance of local organizations that serve a crucial nurturing role. It's just not enough to say, and again, it runs schools in communities where there are amazing organizations, and there are others that families that need assistance and don't always get it. So I have a lot of empathy for kids. Like, for example, in the district where I lead charter schools, in 2015, about 2,000 students started ninth grade. And 4 years later, only 2% graduated from high school ready for college, meaning that you started ninth grade and dropped out, or you did earn your high school diploma 4 years later, but still could not do reading nor math without remediation if you did go to college. And yet in this district, if you had an idea to launch a great school, you couldn't do that because there's a cap on charter schools. So that's a situation where kids in that environment are impeded with the ability to go to great schools. A seven-year-old can't solve that problem, right? So there are, in fact, some structural issues that kids need help. So this idea of pure self-reliance is a myth because you can't solve these problems unilaterally. I mean, you've got to learn a moral code from somewhere, and that's got to come from your parents. It's got to come from a faith community. And unfortunately, in the absence of those, a lot of negative ideas can fill the minds of kids. The reason why I've put forth the free framework is a recognition that agency is individually practiced, but socially empowered. And so, when de Tocqueville made his observations of America, back in the mid-1800s, one of the things he was struck by was the phenomenon of Americans associating. Creating associations, right? So whereas when there were problems, there were local problems, when there were individuals, people gathered together to solve problems. Today, it feels like there's a sort of an attitude of we need Washington or we need some major external force to solve our problems. And I think, again, one of the things I'm trying to do is remind all of us that a lot of our solutions can come from within. But we have to work together. And young people in particular can't be just left alone with the assumption that they can solve problems within their own lives.
All right, think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than in our cars or in our beds. That's why it's so important to invest in the right chair so that you're spending those hours with the right level of support and comfort so that you can get the most productivity out of your day. When you think about it, we do spend so much time worrying about our mattresses and our cars and not our chairs. But X-Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly my favorite place to sit for any reason. So not only does X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar or DVL offer the ultimate customized support, but my X-Chair can even give me a massage or heat up or cool down. And now, thanks to X ClaxChair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. Now, all these unique X-Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort, and that's why I love my X-Chair. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, chair, FEDERALIST.com, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. xchairfederalist.com. Right, and then let's switch to the other side of the coin on the left. One of the pillars of the free agenda, as you say, is entrepreneurship. But you also, in, I think this is actually a chapter title, you say, what is agency, and then why is it so crucial to human flourishing? So where the right may underemphasize the role of community in its emphasis on self-reliance, the left, on the other hand, I think de-emphasizes the importance of agency. There's so many policies that are constantly being proposed on the left that absolutely strip people of agency, even though they sound really good and they might feel good to implement. So why is agency crucial to human flourishing?
Well, this is why this narrative is, I think, so important. So Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is, the main author of the New York Times 1619 Project, put forth an 8,000-word essay in the magazine called What is Owed? And in this article, she basically lays out that Black people, in order to close the racial wealth gap in her mind, have no ability to achieve that. The only way to do it is if the government passes a $14 or $15 trillion reparations program. And in the article, she even says there's nothing a Black person can do. Doesn't matter if you get married, doesn't matter if you get educated, doesn't matter if you buy a home, doesn't matter if you save. None of those things, according to Ms. Jones, are enough to overcome, quote, 400 years of racialized plundering, end quote. So you just think about that narrative. Imagine if you were a 12-year-old kid, you're hearing that, you just think you're powerless. And so the reason it's so important to push back against this narrative is that so many young people are hearing these kinds of messages and they're developing kind of a learned helplessness, that they don't have agency, that they are dependent on some other force to be the driving factor in their own life. And that is more debilitating almost than anything else, because if you don't have the self-belief that you can actually change your circumstances, it diminishes any motivation you have to even try.
On that note, I'm curious, and you write about this, if you could flesh out a little bit of your argument in the context of equality versus equity. What does that dynamic, which has popped up all over the country in public schools, and not just in public schools, also in corporate HR trainings, corporate anti-bias trainings, we see the equality versus equity dynamic everywhere. The Biden administration uses the word equity instead of equality all of the time. In the context of agency, what is the harm of setting up that dichotomy?
Yeah, it is actually phenomenal. With lightning speed, this sort of replacement of the idea of equality and equality of opportunity with equity and equity of outcomes. And there's a massive difference between these two things. There's actually a cartoon that has made its way across the internet. It shows on one side, it says equality. On the other side, it says equity. And there are three people of differing heights trying to look over a fence at a baseball game. And on the equality side of the equation, each of the three people has the same size box. And then obviously, with the same size box with three different people's heights, there are three different landing places in terms of their ability to see. But on the right side is a chart that says equity. And there, the boxes have been rearranged. The tallest person has had their box taken away from them, and the shortest person has been given an additional box. And it's a great visualization of the Marxist ideology from each according to their ability to each according to this, to their need. And what it says is that there's got to be some force that literally is apportioning resources in order to achieve equal outcomes, because in the on the equity chart, all everyone lands in the same place. That's not what this country was founded on. Equality of opportunity, unfortunately, does not guarantee you an outcome, but it has been proven over and over and over again that if young people in particular are being given the right resources based on their individual assets, not based on some assumption, oh, because you're Black, you're inherently oppressed, or because you're white, you're inherently privileged, and so therefore someone is going to take away resources from you or others are going to give you resources simply because of these immutable characteristics. That's a very, very dangerous slope. So in agency, agency respects this idea of individual dignity, common humanity, and equality of opportunity. The moment we start going down the road to say, well, if you're a certain color, you must have the same outcomes. First of all, how do you even achieve that? It doesn't occur. It's actually against natural competition. What is key is that everyone has the level playing field. And that's what agency is all about. And in order to create a level playing field, that's why the institutions of family, religion, education, and entrepreneurship are so crucial, so that every young person has an equal shot, but no guaranteed equal outcome.
And yeah, that last part seems to me to be so key, even just psychologically for a student. And talking about these things in abstract terms, I think sometimes I sit and I wonder how, if you're an individual student, this will end up getting into your head and perhaps, you know, diverting you from a better path. And you talk about the case study. One way that I think made this clear as I was reading, I'm here in Washington, D.C., and you talk about KIPP, and you actually excerpt a quote from, and I think it was an eighth grader at KIPP. Yeah. What can you tell us about the KIPP case study and how it sort of brings to life the problems with these trends?
Well, let me give you two examples. One is something that's happening across the country. It's called these privilege walks, where a teacher will literally line up all of his or her students in a horizontal line and then start giving a series of instructions, where it usually starts off with, if you're white, take 3 steps forward. If you're Black, take 5 steps backward. And after a series of these discussions, all based on these incredibly gross assumptions about privilege or non-privilege, based on your race or some other characteristic, at the end of the day, at the end of the class, you might have a group of white boys at the front and a group of Black girls at the back, with all these negative assumptions, which could be completely false, but it's forcing kids into these roles, which doesn't respect them as an individual, and yet just treats them as if they're just an avatar of a particular race or gender. So those kind of practices just have to be brought to an end. In terms of KIPP, I mean, KIPP is one of the first charter school networks. It's been around now, I think, more than 25 years. It has hundreds of schools across the country, hundreds of thousands of students. For many years, they had a slogan called "Work Hard, Be Nice." And it was it's a very simple 4 words, because it basically sent the signal that your effort matters and your character matters. And that was powerful. Many KIPP graduates actually ascribed their individual success to adopting that ideology within their own lives. Work hard, be nice. Well, in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder, KIPP decided that slogan no longer was valid, because, quote, meritocracy is an illusion, end quote. Consider if you're a low-income kid, you don't have a lot of resources, but you know you do have the ability to work hard, be nice. That if my effort matters, the last thing I want to hear is that meritocracy is an illusion. because now you're saying the system is rigged against you. And so Kip decided to abandon that tagline, which was so disappointing, primarily because of their rationale for doing it. And they replaced it with something like together a world of a better future, some kind of milquetoast slogan. But in my view, that kind of thinking robs young people of the very tools that they have to have a better life, regardless of where they're coming from.
How does this affect young men or boys in particular? I remember actually when I was an intern at AEI, I was helping out on Christina Hoff Sommer's re-released War Against Boys. And one of the problems that she raised originally in that book was the decline of recess and competitive games at recess. So playing a version of tag where everybody wins. It may not hurt girls as much as it hurts boys who sort of thrive and grow in competitive environments. So having seen all of this play out and working in these spaces yourself, how do these trends particularly affect boys?
Yeah, well, the most major trend I think that affects boys and frankly girls too, it's just they're affected differently, is the shift in family structure. You know, it is still the case that the non-marital birth rate for the entire country is still hovering around 40% of all kids are born outside of marriage. And amongst women 24 and under, in 2019, the non-marital birth rate to that group was 71%. 61% in the white community and 91% in the Black community. I mean, the numbers are just staggering. But the challenge of that is that, and again, there are always exceptions, that there are single moms who do amazing things with their kids, as well as their married two-parent households that are dysfunctional. So you always have to acknowledge that nothing is a guarantee of success nor failure. But the data is overwhelming that when young boys are not raised in households with strong fathers, there is usually a direct connection to antisocial behavior later in life. And the impact on young girls is often different, but you tend to see higher rates of teen pregnancy or non-marital births at young ages there as well. And so that's why the first element of free is family, because I want more young people to know that that's the first major decision in their life. Even if they may have been adversely impacted by having a dysfunctional family as they grew up, as you might know, there's some data around what's called the success sequence, that if a young person just finishes their high school degree, gets a full-time job of any kind, just so they learn the dignity and discipline of work, and then if they have children, marriage first, 97% of millennials avoid poverty, and the vast majority enter the middle class. So these are the lessons that even if young boys and young girls are adversely impacted by the family structures, or all these narratives, or participation trophies where everyone, you know, everyone gets the same thing, that their lives don't have to be constrained by those narratives, and they have power within the decisions that they can make.
Now, you discuss the American dream and agency's role in fulfilling the American dream, but also our sort of cultural, how our cultural concept of agency and the different trends that play into it have maybe made it seem less possible for a lot of people. Could you just help sort of answer these questions of what is the American dream? Was it ever possible? Is it less possible now? Basically, how does agency interact with what we think of as the American dream?
The American dream is alive and well, and it's proven every day by literally tens or not hundreds of millions of people that are living it in the United States, plus the tens of millions of people around the world that would, you know, crawl through broken glass to come to this country. I mean, one of the most indelible images from last year was during the Afghanistan, you know, the exit of Afghanistan, when there were literally young Afghanis jumping onto jet planes that were taking off. They were clinging because not just because they were running from what they thought was despair in Afghanistan, but what they thought they had the opportunity to come to the United States. And I think we've got to remind ourselves of that. One of the things I think that one of the things I write about in agency to make this linkage to the American dream is that in order to have agency, you actually have to believe that you live in a good, if not great, country. A country that's not hostile to your dreams, and a country that if you do your part, there will be opportunities on the other side. And the reason these meta-narratives that I'm so pushing against, blame the system and blame the victim, they're sending a message that the American dream is not accessible. And it's just patently false. But it's important that we let young people know that it is possible, but you're not on your own. There are institutions that can help you be ready for opportunity when it comes your way.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bedsheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. How has social media, the rise of social media and its use among young people in particular, affected these concepts of maybe alienation, of family, of religion, education, and maybe even entrepreneurship? How is all of that affected by this very new climate that students are being raised in, especially over the last like 10 or so years?
Yeah, if I could turn back the clock, I think I have a very different way in which social media is utilized. Honestly, it's really destructive, especially for young girls, for adolescent girls who are coming into, you know, their teens. They're dealing with, you know, the normal issues of just what it means to be a young person, but then to have that compounded with 24/7 exposure on social media, where the things that matter might be, well, how many friends do you have? Or what rumors are being shared on social media? It's incredibly, in my view, destructive. And I think there's a lot of families who are recognizing increasingly so that they've got to actually delay when they want their youngsters. You know, there's a movement, I think it's called, wait until eight, you know, wait until eighth grade. And even that, you know, before a child gets access to an iPhone or social media. And frankly, I'm, you know, we're working on even pushing it later for my own children.
I was going to say, that sounds early.
Well, there's a lot of social pressure on parents and kids. It's like, well, mom, you know, you know, TikTok, everyone's on TikTok, everyone's on Instagram. And again, this all connects back to stable family structures. Oftentimes, part of the reason so many kids are spending so much time on social media is that they're not spending time on having evening dinner with their parents, or the television or the social media device becomes effectively the babysitting solution. And so to the degree that more parents can step in to, and by the way, schools as well, to have more in-person activities, sports, clubs. This is how kids used to socially acclimate. What's happening now is that a lot of kids are spending so much time on social media. The whole idea of a courting culture, like asking kids out for dates, a lot of that, you know, now you're on Tinder and all these other social devices where relationships become more transactional versus building honest, vulnerable relationships with people both of the same sex and opposite sex. So I think social media right now, unfortunately, is a impediment to building agency. It's not that it can't be a positive tool, but the way in which it's being deployed right now, I think, creates a lot of social pressure on young people to conform and do things which are not necessarily in their own best interests.
I want to ask more broadly about the interplay between surveillance capitalism and agency, because we do, through all of these like social media platforms, but also just apps like even Google Maps or Amazon, whatever we're shopping for, give up so much of, it was just so much information that otherwise we wouldn't have thought of it as a commodity or data in the past. If you're just flipping through a catalog, as you may have done, you know, 20 or so years ago, as you were shopping, something like that, it is now all commoditized and builds this like massive digital profile of us that corporations can basically purchase and use to shape our behavior. And of course, through advertisements, corporations have always shaped our behavior. But do you see any alarming trends of how this surveillance capitalist behemoth could start eating away at agency? Is it already doing that? Are there things people should be aware of?
Well, just back to this point about social media, I think most young people aren't aware of what is actually being tracked about literally every moment that they're online. You know, that they're posting images that they may think they're only sharing it with a couple of friends, and suddenly, you know, through Snapchat or some other device, you're now all over the internet. So, in a weird way, I think there's an opportunity. When I was at MTV, we ran something called the Truth Campaign. And that was a campaign around smoking and trying to prevent smoking. And we had these images of these corporate CEOs in these boardrooms, you know, sharing information about the dangers of smoking, but that they weren't sharing with young people. And in the Truth Campaign, we mobilized a lot of young people to say, wait a minute, you've been holding this information, and you weren't telling us the truth. And those ads actually really appeal to young people's sense of fairness and wanting to be told the straight story. And I think there's actually an opportunity here. So in designing the high school that we're opening this August, you know, Vertex Partnership Academies, we had traveled the country visiting other high schools, great high schools. And I went to New Orleans and visited a class of ninth graders. And I said to these ninth graders, and this was almost all low-income kids, Asian, Hispanic, and Black. And I said, if you knew that there were a series of decisions in your control that if you made, that the people who make them 97% of the time avoid poverty, would you want to know that? Would you want to know more information? And if they said, well, of course we'd want to know. Why wouldn't you tell us that? And I said, well, there are people who think I'd be moralizing, that maybe you'd be insulted if I told you, and they'd prefer that you just not have that info. And they looked at me with like a third eye, like, what are you talking about? Tell us. And it was this great conversation, because I then proceeded to tell them about the decisions around education, work, marriage, children, 97% of the time avoid poverty. And it wasn't this to say this is what you must do was saying that, look, you're going to be facing decisions in your life, and there are going to be different rewards or consequences, but you're going to be a future decision maker. And so here's the information. And they just felt trusted because someone was actually coming to them with information that they're going to need in the next few years of their life. The reason I think it's important to this whole idea of surveillance capitalism is that we have to be honest with young people so that they can make good decisions about their own lives, so that their agency is not restricted when they discover that, you know, posting some selfies that they thought were private have now suddenly impeded their ability to get into the college of their choice, for example. So I think here is where information really matters. And my hope is that through FREE and these kinds of frameworks, these kinds of institutions, young people will build the trusting relationships with local leaders that can protect them from some of the negative outcomes of what's happening in terms of media and surveillance capitalism.
I want to end on maybe a specific or granular note, thinking about the, there was it was called the child tax credit. It wasn't really a tax credit. It was more of a child payment that was basically made universal during COVID. And there were some immediate results that said this ate right into the child poverty and like immediately into our rates of child poverty. And a policy like that.
Temporary.
Right. Exactly. And so I guess I wanted to ask you, and even when we're thinking about student loan forgiveness, these questions of like the Democrats will say this will have an immediate, instant effect, alleviating poverty, alleviating the struggles of people. So where, if you were designing, you know, or if you were advising people who were designing these policies, how would you help them think about the balance between that instant relief they are tempted to implement and the importance in the long term of agency?
Yeah, almost all the data shows that over the long term, no strings attached type legislation hurts the very people that you are seeking to assist. So in the case of the tax credit, for example, all relationship to work requirements were ended. And what that does is that over time, it erodes people's desire and motivation to work. And so that's why you've seen, I mean, these massive government transfers that occurred over the last couple of years that basically made it more lucrative to take government money than it was to go out and actually get a job hurts agency and hurts human motivation. So my advice when you're crafting these kinds of these kind of policies is to go back to the three T's. Temporary, targeted, and timely, right? So that if there's a person who's facing a financial issue, it's targeted. So it's for a period of time, temporary. You know, there's usually some kind of reciprocal work relationship, you know, where you've either got to have a job or be looking for a job. And this idea of just temporary, targeted, and timely mean, you know, people are getting support when they need it, but it doesn't become a way of life. Any kind of policy that's making a government transfer that doesn't have some kind of reciprocal responsibility connected to it, overwhelming data shows that that actually creates government dependency, erodes individual agency, erodes human motivation. And those are the exact wrong things that we want to do. You'll notice that in my FREE framework, there's no G for government. Not because government isn't important, but we want to create a world in which young people know that the anchors of their life and support are living within these four pillars of family, religion, education, and entrepreneurship, which is their ability to ultimately create wealth, not government dependency. So that would be my advice when referring to those kinds of policies.
Ian Rowe is the author of Agency, which you should make sure to check out now. He's also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. So glad that you came on the podcast to talk about this, Ian. We really appreciate your time.
This was fantastic. Thank you. And let's be free.
Let's be free. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.